This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhid in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There seems to be an increased number of children being admitted, but still not children who are filling out the intensive care units.
That's Professor Mignon McCulloch, president of the South African Pediatric Association, on the impact of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 on young children. Details are coming up. Also, the Ethiopian government says it has recaptured two strategic towns from TPLF rebel fighters. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. In South Africa, scientists have linked the Omicron variant to a sudden increase in numbers of children under the age of 5 being admitted to hospitals with COVID-19. While there have been no fatalities among these cases so far, some of the country's health sector want the government to begin vaccinating very young children. Many countries, mostly developed nations, are inoculating children as young as 5. Darren Taylor has more.
South Africa's health department recently began vaccinating children aged 12 and above. But given preliminary data on Omicron, health organizations now want the state to drop the minimum age for the jab to 5.
There seems to be an increased number of children being admitted, but still not children who are filling out the intensive care units.
Professor Mignon McCulloch is president of the South African Pediatric Association.
And I think if parents are nervous, if they feel that their kids are unwell, if your child is not well, take your child to a healthcare facility, be that a clinic, a GP, your pediatrician, but don't panic about it, because a lot of the children seem to also have quite a mild form of this illness and not critically ill.
The National Institute for Communicable Diseases in South Africa is recording almost 11,000 new COVID-19 infections per day. That's more than double the previous highest rate reported in July.
We are deeply, deeply worried, I must be honest, especially now that there's evidence that those that are aged around 5 years are also becoming victims of this new variant.
Panyaza Lusufi is Education Minister of Gauteng Province, which is currently the epicenter of South Africa's Omicron outbreak. Schools will close for summer vacation late next week, but Lusufi is being pressured to shut the doors now, given the scale of the pandemic's fourth wave in the region.
It's an option that is on the table, but remember the period that we're in is a period of examinations, it's a period of assessment, it's also a period of consolidation of the work done the entire year. So we don't want to be reckless and abruptly end the academic year and make learners to repeat the grades next year. I think it will be disastrous.
McCulloch says most of the children under 10 diagnosed with COVID-19 are actually not ill from the disease, but are in hospital as a result of other ailments, such as broken limbs.
We are seeing an increased number of children who may come in with fevers or a bit of diarrhea or even some chest infections or chest problems and who then are testing positive. The numbers are increasing, but the kids are not terribly, terribly sick at this stage. Our problem is that this new variant was only identified not even a full 2 weeks ago, and so we are actually watching what's happening, and hindsight is always much easier than foresight.
Scientists say people in South Africa are particularly vulnerable to Omicron, as only 36% of the population of 60 million is fully vaccinated. McCulloch urges youngsters in particular to get the jab.
At this time of the year, teenagers want to be out there. They finish school. They want to actually get their lives back again. And so they are also the risky group that actually transmit. They are vaccinating younger children elsewhere in the world, but we are not quite there yet. In the meantime, get everybody else who can be vaccinated, because that obviously will protect the younger children.
She expects South Africa's Medicines Regulatory Authority to soon begin considering an application to approve the use of the Pfizer vaccine for children under 12. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Ethiopian government says it has recaptured two strategic towns, Dese and Kombolcha, from TPLF rebel fighters. According to the French news agency AFP, yesterday's announcement marks another dramatic twist in the 13-month-old conflict that has killed thousands and triggered a deep humanitarian crisis in the north of Africa's most populous nation. The state-run Ethiopian Broadcasting Corporation quoted Prime Minister Abiy, currently at the battlefront, as saying, "The rebels have sustained heavy losses and were unable to cope with the strike by allied forces." On Sunday, TPLF leader Debretsion Gebremichael denied the government was scoring major victories, saying his forces were making strategic territorial adjustments and remained undefeated. More South African companies and institutions are making COVID-19 vaccinations mandatory as another wave of infections driven by the Omicron variant hits the country. To address vaccine hesitancy, South Africa's Religious Forum Against COVID-19, an interfaith group, has been campaigning for religious followers to take the jab. For VOA, Maryse de Klerk reports from Johannesburg.
Everything's ready for you?
This is what?
So I've done three of it already.
Simran Brambat and Birju Patel volunteer in Johannesburg at the BAPS Sri Swaminarayan Hindu Temple vaccination site. The volunteering team is urging the public to get a COVID-19 shot at their government-registered vaccination site. They have vaccinated about 3,000 people since September, but South Africa is seeing a fresh wave of infections driven by the Omicron variant. Volunteering congregant and pharmacist Birju Patel helped setting up the temple's vaccine site.
We wanted to create a site that was comfortable, that people could move around in and get their vaccine quickly. BAPS Charities has done a little bit of outreach work. They are already volunteers of various backgrounds and professions.
South Africa is the worst hit by the pandemic on the continent, with over 3 million confirmed cases and nearly 90,000 deaths. The Omicron variant has many year concerned that those numbers could quickly rise with a fresh wave of infections. The Religious Forum Against COVID-19 has brought various faiths together to pool resources and better address vaccine hesitancy amongst religious believers, says spokesperson Mulana Ibrahim Bam.
There is a parallel movement, so to speak, about people creating hesitancy with regard to vaccines. So let us look at solutions rather than actually being negative towards situations.
South Africa has yet to reach its goal of vaccinating 70% of adults with at least one jab by the end of the year. So far, just 40% of adults have gotten at least one dose. Official statistics indicate youth are the least likely to get vaccinated.
Can you also place on a cotton pad for me?
Student Talen Becha came to the site at the temple because it's close to home and not crowded like others.
I feel that more people should do it because it's empty and it doesn't really affect one.
Analysts say targeting young people should be a top priority. Religious studies professor of the University of Johannesburg, Maria Fromhop, explains.
If these churches and these international or this interfaith forum really wanted to be effective, it would be to find a way to target young people and encourage them to get vaccinated, and then of course to encourage people who have to make decisions about whether to spend 50 rand traveling to a vaccine site to get vaccinated versus feeding their families.
While the Religious Forum Against COVID-19 does not have figures on the rate of vaccination amongst religious believers yet, giving the jab at houses of worship seems to help. The BAPS Sri Swaminarayan Temple says about 90% of its congregants are already vaccinated. Maryse de Klerk for VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Defense ministers of Morocco and Israel have signed a memorandum of understanding that formalizes security relations between the two countries. It is the first of its kind with an Arab state, although intelligence cooperation has been going on between Israel and some Arab countries. For VOA, reporter Angie Omar spoke with Andrew Milburn, former chief of staff of U.S. Special Operations in the Middle East, about what is different in these agreements.
First memorandum of understanding. What is different about this? Well, but here are the key areas. So intelligence sharing has taken place for a long period of time between the Israelis and a number of Arab nations. That's not so much what is new. What is new, it is absolutely comprehensive across the security sector reform. So the Israelis are agreeing to help across the board from training counterinsurgency, but also training, general training. That's a positive sign because it's also linked to kind of an advisory, a mutual collaboration against terrorist threat. The other part about this is both the Israelis and the Moroccans are a little bit quiet about this right now, but certainly the door is open to defense industry. The Israelis have talked about establishing a factory for loitering munitions, this type of drone, effective type of drone that the Israelis have used or have provided. These are called suicide drones by the media. What they are is a precision-guided loitering weapon. So think about this. You've got a bomb, if you like, or a flying bomb with a camera to locate its target, and it can hang around in the area for a period of time, waiting for a target to show up. And now what's interesting about this type of munition, and it's particularly interesting for countries that care about avoiding civilian casualties, so you can target an individual or small group of individuals without harming anyone to either side. So it's tremendously useful in a counterinsurgency fight.
So what does this agreement offer for Israel? And what does Morocco bring to the table for Israel?
That's a great question. There are really three things. Number one is intangible. It's a very mature gesture by both countries. On Israel's part, though, it's clearly not a public relations stunt, but a statement that, look, we are interested globally, we're interested in North Africa. Morocco has been actually a long-term friend of Israel. They collaborated. We're going to get this relationship out in the open, and we're going to formalize it. But it's also a message, a positive message to the United States, that Israel is not just concerned with its own immediate borders, but is willing to be a positive force in other parts of the world. It's a domestic message from the Israeli government to the 750,000 Israelis of Moroccan background. That is important. This is a positive message to them. You are prominent Israeli citizens. We're to have you, etc. Now, the third part, less tangible, it's about money. Well, it's about business, but it's about benefiting both the Moroccan and the Israeli economy. Israeli defense industry has some cutting-edge technologies. Mm-hmm. We mentioned the drones, but also cyber. Cyber security, but also cyber, what we call offensive cyber operations. Now, there's likely to be, you know, there's nothing in this MOU that specifically talks about that, but it kind of opens the door for that going ahead.
Would that agreement lead to more cooperation between Morocco and Israel in combating terrorism in Africa?
I would hope so. And again, security can only be a force for the good. We're seeing France, mm-hmm. downscaling in Mali, and Macron just earlier this year talking about reducing operational Barkhane mm-hmm. and pulling troops. The United States has already pulled U.S. forces out of Somalia and out of Niger. So from the viewpoint of both Morocco and Israel, a stable Africa is better for overall security. There's no place where groups like, on one hand, Hezbollah or the more traditional jihadi can find succor. But there's also an element of resources. Africa is rich in resources. Mm-hmm. And the third part is from a point of view of markets. You know, we talked about defense industries, talked about various other services Israel can offer Africa and Morocco, perhaps in combination. Africa's a great market, and it's very interesting getting back to this deal with the drone, manufacturing of drones. You know, this isn't an export deal. It is an agreement to set up an Israeli factory in Morocco with a Moroccan workforce to manufacture these drones at a lower cost, by the way, than if they'd be manufactured in Israel, possibly with a view to selling them within the African market.
That was Andrew Milburn, former chief of staff of U.S. Special Operations in the Middle East, speaking with reporter Angie Omar. A Kenyan police officer in the capital, Nairobi, has gone on a rampage, fatally shooting 6 people, including his wife, before shooting himself. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Running battles between police and angry youth after a policeman killed 6 people, including his wife. The police officer shot himself. Among those killed were 3 motorbike riders. Police commander in the Goreti area, Francis Wahome, says the policeman went on a rampage and used his gun against innocent people. He says there was one of our officers who was on duty and excused himself and left with a gun to his home and killed his wife. The commander says he killed 7, including himself. There are 2 people who were injured and are receiving treatment. According to some witnesses, the officer shot at motorbikes passing on the road and anyone found on his path. Police tried to calm the situation and blocked angry residents planning to storm the police station. Officials say an investigation will be conducted. In August, the National Police Service Commission said mental health issues were affecting the work of some police officers. The commission deployed 59 counselors to help police officers with psychological and mental health issues. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
UN agencies are expressing alarm at escalating violence in Sudan's volatile Darfur region. Intercommunal clashes in recent weeks have displaced thousands of people in a region already struggling with an economic crisis and rising food insecurity. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Sudan has been in economic recession since 2018. The United Nations estimates half of Darfur's population, about 6.2 million people, will need humanitarian assistance in 2022. It notes many people are suffering from a prolonged dry spell, pests, diseases, and growing hunger. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the situation in Jebel Moon in West Darfur is particularly tense. Speaking from the capital Khartoum, the head of OCHA's office in Sudan, Paolo Emerson, says conflicts have erupted over access to dwindling resources, including arable land and water. She says all communities in the region are affected by increasingly violent flare-ups triggered by the deteriorating economic situation.
The most recent events took place when there was fighting on 17 November between nomads and farmers in Jebel Moon locality. About 50 people were killed, or close to 10,000 people were displaced. Over 2,000 people fled to Chad, and 771 houses were burned or looted.
A recent interagency team led by OCHA visited 32 affected villages to assess needs. Speaking from Al Janaina, UN Refugee Agency Coordinator for Darfur, Toby Howard, describes the level of carnage unleashed upon devastated communities in the villages visited.
There we came across appalling images of destruction. We found a situation of ongoing extreme tension, and all communities on alert and expecting further violence. The mission also located groups of displaced families living in open areas on the fringes of Jebel Moon Mountain, from where they told us they could scatter quickly and hide inside the mountain in the event of further attacks.
While there, Harwood says the UNHCR and partners delivered emergency shelter to 1,600 newly displaced families, as well as other life-saving supplies, including jerry cans, sleeping mats, kitchen sets, and mosquito nets. He notes the needs of the displaced are enormous, but fears they may not be met. He says the deteriorating security situation and growing violent criminality are restricting the ability of aid agencies to access affected areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroonian authorities say clashes between ranchers and fishermen left at least 10 people dead and scores wounded Monday, forcing hundreds to flee into neighboring Chad. The clashes in Cameroon's north broke out over water scarcity, a problem that authorities have struggled to address. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Musgum and Arab Shua community leaders in Cameroon's northern border with Chad said a bloody conflict erupted between cattle ranchers and fishers in Olumsa, a northern village, on Monday. Cameroon government officials in Logon and Shari, an administrative unit called Division across Cameroon's northern border with Chad, said at least 10 people were killed and more than 20 wounded, with 10 left in critical condition. Mas Mazra is a community leader in Logon and Shari. He says he is pleading with the population of Logon and Shari to stop bloodshed and attacks on civilians who are not concerned with the fresh fisher cattle rancher conflicts that started on Monday. He says the conflict between cattle ranchers and fishers should not degenerate into an armed dispute between Musgum and Arab Shua communities. Mazra said Musgum and Arab Shua community leaders have asked the Cameroon government to find lasting solutions to the conflict that is becoming a regular occurrence. The central government in Yaoundé has acknowledged the attack and says several hundred people escaped to Chad. Military officials said they have deployed troops to maintain peace in Logon and Shari. The clashes happened 4 months after a similar conflict. In August, Cameroonian officials said at least 11,000 civilians fled from Logon and Shari to Chad after a conflict over water between cattle ranchers and fishermen killed 40 people and wounded 70. Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, sent a delegation led by Mijiyawa Bakari to Logon and Shari to negotiate an end to the crisis. Bakari said fishers agreed to stop digging holes ranchers said would kill their cows, sheep, and donkeys. The fishers dig the holes to conserve water and lure their catch. Cattle ranchers also agreed not to take their cattle to areas reserved only for fishing. Mijiyawa Bakari is the governor of Cameroon's far north region, where Logon and Shari is located. Bakari says Cameroon is giving subsidies to fishers to create community fish ponds and reduce the number of people going to fish in areas where there are regular conflicts between cattle ranchers and fishermen. Bakari says Cameroon is educating cattle ranchers to practice new methods that reduce land destruction and depletion of natural resources. He says it is imperative for all cattle to return to cattle ranches. Augustine Jamshi is a member of the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, a coalition of civil society organizations that advocate for climate issues and environmental justice. Jamshi says clashes over water resources will continue to increase and become complex in the Lake Chad Basin because water and other resources are diminishing, while the number of people and animals that need water for survival is increasing.
It is necessary for the government to educate the people to make judicious use of the resources and provide alternative means of livelihood. They need to explore new technology like irrigation, water capturing and storage, and make use of underground water reserves. That is the only way to go about it. When the population is made to be part of decision making, that diffuses a lot of tension because water-related conflicts are very, very complex.
The Lake Chad Basin Commission, an 8-member intergovernmental organization overseeing water and other resources in the Lake Chad region, says the lake's water resources have diminished by 70% within the past 50 years. However, the population depending on the lake for their livelihoods has increased from 3.5 million in 1960 to over 45 million inhabitants in 2020, According to the commission, member countries include Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, the Central African Republic, Niger, and Benin. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington.